is you had quite a distinguished life experience. You were CISO of Nissan for a number of years. You are currently CISO of Ingram Microcomputers. For everybody that doesn't know, Ingram Microcomputers is one of the biggest IT companies in the world. If I understand correctly, it's in the process of being purchased for about $7.2 billion. So it means that you're dealing today with someone that has quite a business experience. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have him today. So our class is primarily focused on cybersecurity, but any topic in IT is interesting to students. What I want to focus on is really ideally showing them that cybersecurity is important, showing them that cybersecurity has jobs and they are high-paying jobs, because bottom line is money is important. So again, thank you for accepting my invite. And with that said, do you want to start talking before taking some questions?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I'll start doing a brief introduction. You did a great job, and then I'll maybe go through pretty quickly the Q&As, because I think I can probably get through them in 20, 25 minutes, and then we can open it up for questions if that sounds okay. So I'll start off. As was mentioned, I started my career. I graduated from the University of Colorado at Boulder. At that time, I had an internship at IBM, and so I did the first 5 years of my careers at IBM Global Services, doing a variety of things, mostly in development and application maintenance. And did that for a variety of customers, about 20 to 30 customers. One of those was Nissan. And so as Nissan grew in its outsourcing, which it started in 1999, it was very early on the bandwagon of outsourcing. And what they did is they took several thousand jobs in the United States and gave them all to IBM except for 20. So they literally did 100% outsourcing. I came in a little bit later, 2 years later, focused mostly on middleware and integration. And then eventually Nissan hired me when they decided to insource about 200 jobs. They realized that it probably wasn't a good idea to have an outsourcer have all of their business knowledge in IT. And so I came over as an enterprise architect and joined Nissan there. And then went through a variety of different positions within Nissan. Enterprise architecture, and then infrastructure management, data center management, and then in 2010 landed in security. So the CIO at the time said, "Hey, Forrest, we don't have an information security team. I'd like for you to start one. It looks like a challenge, and I think it's going to be big." Little did she know, in 10 years it was going to be gigantic. But she was very smart in that, and I'm very glad that I took her advice to get into cybersecurity. So I started Nissan's team in 2010, and it started with a relatively small team. And I went and got my digital forensic certification. And as we built out our team, hired additional people, I was encouraged at that time by the county sheriff, who was vying for Nissan's help to do digital forensics on the law enforcement side. He asked us to, he and I partnered and created a program where Nissan donated time, because I had hired a whole bunch of ex-law enforcement guys that did digital forensics. And he wanted us to, help him for free. And we said, okay, this is, Nissan's the largest employer in the state of Tennessee, largest employer in the county. We'll do something philanthropically. We built out a digital forensic lab for him. And he said, oh, and by the way, I want you to do it too. So the county trained me to be a deputized police officer, and I did high-tech crimes and investigations for about 5 years. Before I left Nissan, which was really fun. I kind of joke it's fun to be a geek with a badge and gun. But it was very interesting to see both the corporate side as well as the law enforcement side, and how there's plenty of crossover there. And then, towards the end of my time at Nissan, it was getting kind of easy. We had built out a pretty good program, and I was looking for a challenge. And so when Ingram Micro came knocking, it looked like an interesting opportunity. Ingram is probably the largest company you've never heard of. They have three different business lines. We started in 1978 doing logistics. So we're most known for our logistics, and that's where we make most of our money and profit. We have 200 warehouses with 25 million square feet across the world. and we distribute 80% of the world's technology. So if you buy a Cisco switch, it comes through Ingram Micro. If you buy a Palo Alto firewall, it comes through Ingram Micro. If you buy Levi's jeans online, it comes through Ingram Micro. So the difference is we put the company's logo on it, not Ingram Micro's logo, and we ship it from one of our warehouses in 70 different countries. So if you buy IT technology from Amazon, you're very likely getting it from an Ingram Micro warehouse in an Amazon box with an Amazon label. And so that's how we make, you know, a large portion of our almost $60 billion in revenue a year. The other part of what we do is technology services, which is value-added reselling. We're very big in the large software and hardware sales area of IT. So most companies know of us, most IT departments know of us, but because we do only business-to-business sales in that arena, we don't have the brand recognition for the average consumer. And then finally, a couple of years ago, we started a business unit called Cloud Blue, and we looked at what was happening in technology, hardware and software sales, and we said, with the migration towards cloud, we need to think very strategically about this. And so we built an app store for businesses that sells software as a service and cloud services. So if you're an IT CIO and you want to simplify your cloud buying experience, which can be pretty crazy. I mean, some of the cloud contracts are hundreds of pages long. And it sounds simple to go buy AWS or cloud services within a company, but by the time you get through the legal department and procurement and everything else, you're probably 5 or 6 months down the road. If you're trying to sign up with AWS or Azure for the first time. So we simplify that experience with one contract, and then you can buy over 4,000 products in our marketplace. You can buy Azure, AWS, Workday, SuccessFactors, Salesforce, you name it, any of the major SaaS products or cloud offerings are offered through our marketplace. And we've sold already 13 million seats in just 3 years. So it was a good idea in the sense that we were able to make that all work and be profitable. So I joined Ingram Micro. Really, the intent was to improve the cybersecurity function and make it more mature. And I'll talk a little bit about that because it gets into some of the questions in a moment. But that's really what Ingram Micro does, is those three business units. And as was mentioned, recently we announced that we're being acquired by a company called Platinum Equity. It's an equity firm based out of LA. Currently, we're owned by HNA Airlines out of China. So very interesting to be in cybersecurity and working for a Chinese company, Chinese-owned company. They bought us several years ago and have been managing us, although we've got agreements with the US government because of national security interests, that we've got an arm's length agreement. We operate independently as a US company. And I kind of joke, the only thing we really do for HNA Airlines is send them the profits of the business that we do. So very interesting to see a local equity firm get involved. And hopefully that means for us that there's more investment in continuing to improve the company and where we want to go, including in IT and cybersecurity investments. So very much looking forward to that. So I will jump into some of the questions here. The first question that was asked was, what are your biggest challenges in regards to cybersecurity governance? It seems to be a spongy word, according to one of my leaders. I find it's a big sell in much of the corporate world. And you're absolutely right. Governance is a super interesting word. It's very ambiguous. The way I like to think about it in my organization is, what controls and countermeasures do you put in place to minimize risk? At the end of the day, that's really what governance is. It's pretty synonymous with that. When you look at what we do, you kind of measure that, what controls and countermeasures you have against frameworks. I've decided to use at Ingram Micro the NIST cybersecurity framework, but there's others like CIS controls and other NIST frameworks. But the NIST cybersecurity framework seems to be gaining in popularity, including in Europe. Which tends to have its own set, but they tend to, I'm starting to see the NIST cybersecurity framework grow globally, which is interesting. And so a couple interesting things about governance, when you think about it from a business perspective, you have to really balance the controls. Any framework like the NIST cybersecurity framework, you can end up with 500 or 600 controls that you're trying to manage against, and not all of those controls are as important as others. So you really have to look at what the return on risk investment is. And so take ROI that you learn in business school and translate that into cybersecurity and or any other risk function like legal or risk management, whatever, it doesn't matter. You make an investment and you expect to get a reduction of risk. If you can manage that reduction of risk compared to your investment, then you start to make really, really good decisions on what you should do. And so you start to look at those 500 controls and you say, really, maybe 350 are important and I can absolutely just completely skip the other 150. And so that's what, in my mind, governance is all about, is making really good business decisions as to what controls and countermeasures you implement within your company. And I think what's important here is that you really have to have a good understanding of both the business and financial side, as well as the cybersecurity and the tech side, to be effective there. So a good CISO is going to have a good balance between both of those. And most of my leaders have really good business as well as technical backgrounds so that they can make those good decisions. You also hear sometimes compliance intermixed with governance. And so you'll hear like Sarbanes-Oxley, PCI compliance, ISO 27001, SOC 1 Type 2 audits, all of those type of buzzwords around the different compliance programs. And what I'll say is that you're most successful if you allow governance to drive your strategy and compliance will come along for the ride. And what I mean by that is if you're doing all the right things from a governance perspective and you're picking the right controls, you'll naturally become compliant with Sarbanes-Oxley, PCI, and all the rest. So it's more important that you focus on risk reduction versus spending money just to be compliant. And then finally, I'll say probably the most important element of governance to the CEO of the company and the board of directors is they want to see risk visibility. They want to see where are we at, where do we have weakness, where, you know, what is our security posture. They want to see it benchmarked against other companies. Sometimes you hear the phrase risk appetite. How much risk am I willing to accept because I'm not going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on cybersecurity to try to get to Department of Defense level protection? That's not reasonable, nor is it practical. So what is my risk appetite? What am I willing to accept in terms of risk in order to be agile in business? So cybersecurity also has an element here of having to enable the business versus stopping the business from doing something. So that it's an attitude that the CISO has to adopt to make sure that your company can ship products, can sell services and products, make revenue and profit, and as a result, the cybersecurity function is successful. So it's a very interesting balancing act when you get to that level. And then finally, the saying that is very important that I reiterate to my team is you can't get to zero risk. So it's not possible to completely protect the company. So as important as protecting the company is how you respond when risk realizes itself. So what are the things you're going to do to practice when things go bad? And make sure that you're really exceptional at responding to incidents and events. So incident management becomes extremely important in governance. And so that's, you know, if I had to kind of summarize governance and security governance, those are the most important elements to me as I run our cybersecurity function. The next question is, what are your 2021 predictions for cybersecurity arising from the pandemic and all the political issues in the United States? So what's interesting here is I'm probably one of the few people that will say, I'm not sure that the pandemic or the political situation changed a lot. It changed the type of threats. So instead of seeing, you know, the scams around the latest hurricane or the latest event that's trying to draw on your emotions and sympathy to get you to send money to the bad guys, you're really seeing it around the pandemic. Can I get people to sign up for a vaccination or give them a vaccination hoax or whatever? And so you see those types of things. You also see maybe a little bit of increased risk in having everyone work from home and the challenges around getting machines patched and staying up to date when not everyone connects to the VPN every single day, et cetera. But for the most part, these are all risks that we've had for quite some time. They just might be slightly increased because of the change in the dynamic of people working from home or the fact that people are very emotional about the pandemic. I'll talk about SolarWinds in a moment because I think that that's an element here. But if I look at predictions for 2021, you know, we've always said that it's going to get interesting when you start to affect people's safety or health. And very recently, you saw the attack on the water plant in Florida. And so I see in 2021 and beyond, more and more of those events occurring where critical infrastructure and other organizations are really going to have to start paying attention to cybersecurity and looking at it as a health and safety issue. I'm not sure that we do that today. I think we see it as more of a, let's protect people's data. Let's make sure that credit cards don't get stolen or people's personal data doesn't get affected. But we really don't pay a lot of attention as to how it can affect health and safety. Obviously, I worked for Nissan, and so I'll mention cars and the cybersecurity of cars as a potential issue. There was a very well-published situation that occurred several years ago with Jeep and a couple of security researchers being able to hack the Jeep vehicle and take control of steering, acceleration, and braking. And if you look at where cars have gone with drive-by-wire versus being mechanical, so switches are controlling and electronic systems are controlling steering, braking, and acceleration, you can see where cars could become weapons or could, you know, cripple highways and the ability to travel if they were to be, you know, attacked at a large scale. So what I see in 2021 and beyond is the more sophisticated attackers, the state governments, the more organized groups really starting to prey on organizations that don't pay attention to cybersecurity as a health safety issue. And the last thing that I'll probably say here in terms of predictions is kind of interesting is I'm really focused at Ingram Micro and at any company that I would be a CISO for on corporate threats. So I'm going to make a huge distinction between consumer-based malware and threats and corporate threats. Because if you look at it from my perspective, it doesn't really bother me if one of our employees, from a risk perspective, if one of our employees installs malware that steals their Bank of America account and password. I'm sympathetic and I'm empathetic to the employee that got their information stolen, but it really doesn't affect the company. So if you look at that and you say, if you can erase, you know, from my perspective, from a CISO and a corporate perspective, all of the consumer malware and just focus on corporate issues, you're really looking at things that are going to cause disruption. You're looking at ransomware and you're looking at, for Ingram Micro at our large warehouses, the systems that run the conveyor belts and Internet of Things, right, that run in all of our warehouses that can cripple our ability to do business. So those are the things very similar to health safety issues that are going to be problematic in 2021 and beyond. So the next question is, we already saw SolarWinds affected. What other technologies do you think are at highest risk? So I think what we learned from SolarWinds, and we knew for quite some time because we've been talking about what we call securing the supply chain for years. Back in 2012, we had created security addendums that went on all of our contracts at Nissan that were trying to hold suppliers accountable for cybersecurity issues. And we saw, you know, a couple years ago, several manufacturing plants for vehicles go down because of the WannaCry virus, which, you know, was again ransomware and very disruptive. So I think what I would say is the highest risk are the products that we buy in our supply chain and the potential that they could be used or leveraged or manipulated in a way to gain entry into your network or your systems or your processes to cause harm and disruption. So that's probably, I would say, the highest risk items for the next couple of years is securing the supply chain. And that's what SolarWinds really, that's where it became an issue. They were compromised and every major company and government entity used them because they're monitoring software. The other thing that made SolarWinds pretty egregious is if you look at it from a cyber perspective, cybersecurity practitioners allowed it to talk to almost every asset in the company, which means we were poking firewall holes. We were poking holes in almost every single firewall so it could touch every asset. And not only did we do that, but we also gave it a privileged account to talk to those assets because that's what the software required. So we really didn't, so SolarWinds in the design of their product didn't really leverage the least privilege principle. Perfect problem, right? And I saw someone say perfect storm, and they're absolutely right. because you had elevated access, access to everything, and something that was, you know, trusted by most companies. So I think when we look at 2021 and beyond, we're really going to start like taking a look at things like monitoring software, backup and recovery software, anything where we install an agent on every machine to do something. And we're going to look at a lot of those technologies and make sure that we're leveraging them in a way that we reduce the amount of privilege, maybe section them out so that there we don't have as many holes in the firewall, et cetera. So that, I think, is what we learned from SolarWinds. The next question is, we know AWS is trending right now. What other vendors and technologies do you think will stick out this year? So Forrest's philosophy on cloud is, I think it's very trendy. It's not, I'm not, you know, we rebrand things in IT about every 10 years and they end up being kind of the same thing over and over again. What's interesting about cloud is it was sold as being cheaper, and now I have to be careful how I say this because my company sells cloud, but cloud maybe isn't as cheap as companies thought it would be. The cloud folks have gotten smart about how they do their subscription-based pricing, and it's at least at par, if not a little bit more expensive. And so then you have to say, what is the value of cloud? And a lot of that is time to market. So companies understand that they can do cloud faster, better, more agile, and there's something to be said about that. I would also say, you know, in terms of what's trending, software as a service is probably a more interesting proposition than even cloud, because companies are focusing on a single thing and they're doing it really, really well, and they're doing it better than you could do it internally with custom development. And they're considering that concept of their product needs to have enough features and functionality to be, you know, to be agile depending on the business that uses it or installs it. and then on top of all of that, they're realizing that it can be profitable. So the companies that are creating SaaS solutions realize that subscription-based pricing compared to perpetual licenses is a much more profitable opportunity than just normal software. So they're realizing that if they can bundle software as a service on top of a platform and sell it without the company really having to do anything, they can sell that as a subscription and they make a lot of money doing it. I know because Ingram, as part of the Cloud Blue, we sell those subscriptions and we do the reoccurring billing on a monthly basis, and they are extremely profitable contracts compared to a perpetual license, which is historically what we used. So that's what I see as really being really trending over the next couple of years and getting better and better is software as a service. Really getting out of the cloud elements, you know, Azure or AWS, the SaaS companies might use them, but companies are really probably going to focus more on SaaS. What's also interesting about SaaS is, you know, if you look at the IT departments within companies, you don't need your IT department to do it. The marketing folks can go buy their own applications. HR can go buy their own applications. And it's really, it's a very interesting result when it comes to where IT has a role within the company. And I think we're going to see IT in the business having to work closer together than they have in the past, in order for IT to, you know, have a foothold in controlling all of this data and the services and the applications that are being bought by the business. So the next question is, how did you get to your current position? I think I talked a little bit about that at the beginning in my introduction. What I'll say, probably the most important part of getting to where I'm at is the rotations I did in IT. I didn't start in cybersecurity. Cybersecurity, the folks that are best at cybersecurity have a well-founded base in all of IT. So I'll give you kind of the example of when I interviewed at Ingram Micro, I interviewed with the CEO, Alain Monet, and the first question out of his mouth was, are you technical? Which is a very interesting question if you're an IT executive. You don't want to come off as super technical. You want to come off as a business leader. But luckily, I had been coached by HR and the others. He was looking for a technical leader. And so he wanted me to explain to him that I was a certified digital forensic expert, that I could write code, that I could do all of these things, because in his mind, that meant I could better protect the company, that I could ask the right questions, I could challenge our associates and our employees to make sure we were doing all the right things to protect the company. So the best advice I can give is if you aspire to a leadership position, is to get a really well-rounded base, to take that opportunity to go from department to department in IT and figure out what you can become passionate about and then hone in on that area between year 7 and 10 of your career. That's how you probably have the best opportunity to get to a leadership position. And then finally, the last question on here is, or second to last question, what are your thoughts on certs, including CISSP? I think certs are good. I think it's more important to apply the concepts in the certs. I think the CISSP cert is a great cert to have because if you look at the job boards, you will notice that most cybersecurity jobs have that as a requirement. So get your CISSP out of the way. And then what I would say is focus on more technical certs, like a digital forensics or reverse engineering malware. SANS is a go-to if you want to look at the more technical certs, and a very well-respected organization when it comes to cybersecurity training. And you will notice it's probably respected because it's not cheap. Most of their courses cost between $6,000 to $7,000. And I know that they've got various educational opportunities where it costs less, but they charge us $6,000 to $7,000. Every time I want to send someone to SANS school and have them get a cert in any number of areas. They do have lots of courses. They have, I think, between 30 and 40 courses in different areas, and they have tracks too. So you can, take several courses in a row and become an expert in a certain area of cybersecurity. So I look for both. I look for CISSP when I'm going to hire someone, as well as something more technical. And finally, the question is, how do you get noticed to get a job? My answer is do something unique. The last person, one of the last ones that we hired out of college at UC Irvine here in California, what I noticed about him is he had started in college an online personal training and nutrition website and was making good money at it. So not only did he do it, he was making good money, which means to me that he's got a good entrepreneurial spirit. I like that. I like the passion, the motivation. And so, he is a CS grad and we hired him straight into cybersecurity. Just based on the fact that was one thing that, caught our attention and caught our eye. So the point there is whatever you do, whether it's an internship or something that distinguishes you from your peers, just make it notable, make it obvious that it's something that's really cool, and make sure that you market it properly in your resume. Because the marketing in your resume is an extremely important element to get HR to notice you, to then pass it on to the hiring manager. So remember, you've got to step in between. So do something that kind of wows the HR folks and says, hey, this one, I'm going to put this one in the pile for review. And so that's all the questions that I have on my list. And like I said, I'd leave 30 minutes for Q&A. And I saw some things on the chat pop up, so I might start there. But if anyone has any questions, feel free to unmute and ask them directly.
Yeah, I did put a few in. I put one in there too. We're really trying to figure out how to put our cybersecurity together with supply chain. We have supply chain offerings on the business side of the school, and I'm on the IT side for cyber, but I don't think it's the right supply chain stuff, to be honest. It's much more logistics and managerial stuff. And we're really trying to figure out what it is that we need to incorporate into the cyber programs at either the bachelor's or the master's levels or both that really gets them to that supply chain cyber role, I think we all agree that's the goal. It's just like, okay, so what does that look like?
Yeah, so there's a couple elements to it, right? There's obviously the risk transference. That's risk sharing and risk transference. That's really, really important here. So that's all contracts. And what's interesting about contracts is the attorneys that we have, I've never met an attorney that is technical enough to write an IT security addendum. It just doesn't happen. So we end up writing them and we collaborate and we put them together. But what's interesting there is, probably the best course that prepared me for that was one of my business management courses on business law. Because you do a huge element of cybersecurity is the legal aspect of it, right? Everything from I can't tell you how many times my email was subpoenaed at Nissan. in various cases related to cybersecurity. Class action lawsuits, the amount of testimony I did in court, the amount of depositions that I had to do, there's a huge legal element. And so if you want to be very successful on that side of it, on the leadership executive side, a good foundation in college is a good way to start, right, in business law. The second part of that is realizing that when we started at Nissan, we focused on IT companies and securing the supply chain. Until the company that made screws for the cars got hit with ransomware and they took the plant down because they could not deliver screws to the plant. And it was just-in-time manufacturing. And then we realized, wow, it's definitely well beyond IT things that cybersecurity can have an impact on just about every aspect of our business. And so there's that element of it. There's things in this murky word governance that we call that talk about making sure that the companies comply with the addendum. So when you're going to get business from a big company, you'll sign almost anything. We found. So companies will sign up for almost any obligation because they know that it's very unlikely that the company is going to call them out or audit it. So we do have an audit team that, and we force rank our contracts and we say which ones are the most risky. And we do leverage the audit clause in the contract to go and look at it. And in almost every single one, we have findings. So it's an area that's very immature in the cybersecurity space because people will sign up for stuff, obligate their company to do something, then not do it. And you realize a lot of risk in this space. So
Forrest, can I ask you a question?
Yep.
Have you looked at NIST 853 Ref 5? We had recently Ron Ross talk to us, and he did mention supply chain being one of the new families. And I would think that it would be very relevant.
So absolutely. So especially 853, especially if you're selling to the government, which we do. So government sales, the procurement office has a whole bunch of new rules around securing the supply chain for the government that you have to comply with. And they're the most aggressive that's out in industry. So if you learn about the what's all required in the, I think it's the Government Cybersecurity Supply Chain Act or whatever it is, it includes 853 because it's been around for a while, but it's also, it goes well beyond it. So I agree, 853 is very important.
Could I ask a question from you for a second?
Yep.
All right, I kind of follow a lot of cybersecurity news and trying to keep up with it, get as much exposure as I can. And I noticed that a lot of ransomware was being paid in cryptocurrency, and I thought that was silly. But then I looked into it, and I think the reason has to do with it not being able to be traced.
Yep.
Is there something that legally we might push to make that? Because it seems like maybe a government might not like that kind of currency.
Yeah, so I'm going to switch hats to my law enforcement career side of it and tell you, that, yeah, absolutely. Cryptocurrency is not traceable. Very rarely is it traceable. And so that's why they use cryptocurrency as the ransom, you know, the ransom payment mechanism. The other problematic part to this is that we pay it. As companies, we pay it. It's kind of like the policies that the US has, we won't negotiate with terrorists. If no one paid ransoms, it would not still be happening. But because companies are the first ones to pay, and if you look at cybersecurity insurance policies, you can actually buy an adder to your cybersecurity insurance policy so that the insurance company pays the ransom, so that you can get your business operations back up and going. So ethically, if you look at it from kind of an ethics perspective, you know, are we doing the right things in industry to stop that problem from happening? Probably not. And cryptocurrency on top of it makes it even more difficult because you go to the FBI or the Secret Service or your local sheriff's department and you say, I paid in cryptocurrency. And literally as an investigator, I'm like, okay, case closed. There's not a lot I can do for you. You just wired your money away.
So would you say it'd be better if companies stopped paying that or?
Yes.
Okay.
At every company that I've worked at, I've never paid ransom. And if you have the right backup and recovery tools and you test them regularly, there's no reason you should have to pay a ransom. You just restore from backup. But the problem is most companies are not backing up properly, so they can't do that restoration, and they end up in a situation where their only option left is to rebuild from scratch or pay the ransom. And when they look at it from a business perspective, the people that do this are really, really smart. They'll dictate an amount that is slightly less than rebuilding from scratch.
And if I may mention something, for those of you who may use cryptocurrency, just know that it's not compatible with working with Uncle Sam. It's a lack of preference for US dollar, and it's a reportable event to Uncle Sam. For those that work in government, just FYI. I had another question for you. So I initially wrote this question. How do you survive saying no to the board and the CEO? Because my experience, I do cybersecurity in commercial world, and telling no to business managers is something that doesn't go very well. But typically I don't, you know, there's no other choice than saying no. How do you survive saying no to them?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. I would say part of it is the way in which you advertise what you're doing. There's a huge element of sales and marketing that you do at the CEO and the board level. And it's better to preempt the conversation than to be asked. So a lot of what I do is provide them with a lot of information so they understand where we're at. And the only time I think I probably ever said no was when I was asked by a board of directors whether or not we could get to, why we can't get to zero risk. And the individual argued with me because he believed we could get to zero risk with the right amount of management and control and leadership. He had in his mind that you could get to zero risk. And so in my explanation, I used, you know, we can't get to zero risk in litigation. We can't get to zero risk in product liability. What makes him think that we can get to zero risk in cyber? It's a risk management function. And in that particular case, the other members of the board understood it. And so it really wasn't a huge issue. But to survive saying no, I think the most important element is education and information. Generally, if you walk them through, and I joked with my former boss, if you walk them through the story of any situation in cybersecurity and you give them the right pieces of information and the right facts, they should logically come to the same conclusion that the answer is no. You shouldn't have to tell them. So it's all about how you present the information and in such a way that they come to the same logical conclusion.
Your answer is very interesting. I had a case where a business manager, a senior manager, told me, you know, what's the worst we risk? Let's just do it. And I was saying, well, it's very dangerous. And they said, what's the worst we risk? I mean, have you experienced something like that? Where people are so willing to take advantage of an opportunity that they want to forego security?
Many, many, many times. So yes, and we see that every day. And you'll hear me always say that it really is a business decision on how much risk a company takes on. It's not the cybersecurity team's responsibility to accept risk. The business needs to accept risk because they're the ones making the money, right? So what we've done and what I've done in both companies is if you look at the finance elements of a company, they have signatory power, delegation of authority, some control around how much an individual at a certain level can spend. And so maybe a senior manager can spend $10,000. And if you're going to spend over $10,000, you need to go to a director and then a VP. And eventually, if you get, you know, like an Ingram Micro, if you spend over $3 million, you've got to go to the CFO and he has to sign off on your expense. We do very much the same thing with cyber risk. We say, if you're going to accept this amount of cyber risk, you need to be at this level. And it goes all the way up to the CEO. And that's part of what I mentioned earlier with risk visibility. is that the CEO ought to be aware if a manager is going to go sign off on $50 million of cyber risk. That's probably not the right level to sign off on that level of risk. So we've actually created a signatory level or a delegation of authority policy around who can accept what level of cyber risk, and then not only each individual case, but cumulatively. So that manager can't go up, you know, sign up for 100 different contracts of 500K cyber risk. At some point, he's going to run out of his delegation of authority, and he's going to have to go a level above. And that's really how I've dealt with the individuals that do it. And I can tell you, I had a department at Nissan that was really happy to sign off on it until it cumulatively got to the point of where the VP of that department had to start signing off on it. And he said no every time because he didn't want his name associated with it. He recognized that that was too much financial risk to the company, that he shut it down. I didn't even have to do it. So that's one way to measure, you know, within the company, to use tools that already exist and help people make better decisions.
But what do you do if you disagree on the value of the risk?
So that's the interesting part of the policy. I determine the value. Because it's signatory. So risk is only, you know, you don't really know the value until it realizes itself. But what we say is, based on our training and experience, we're the best ones to assess the value. And if they disagree with the value, no big deal. Convince your boss, who has to sign off on it, that it's a difference in value and he should sign pretty quickly. Most of the time that doesn't happen.
Okay. Your experience, you mentioned China. We discussed in my class recently that they found that 60% of the spying for industrial and commercial comes from China. Is that your experience, that a lot of issues come from China right now?
So at Nissan, yes. At Ingram Micro, no, because I joke that when you're a Chinese-owned company, they don't attack you.
That maybe is a good solution, yes. Okay.
So. Apparently that will soon change.
Okay. Someone mentioned a question about data forensic certification. David, do you want to ask your question about the data forensic certification?
Yeah, so it was just, you had mentioned that you hadn't been in cybersecurity and then you kind of shifted over. I don't know how sharp of a shift that was. Was it kind of like a shock, or did it, you know, just kind of the time length that it required you to do?
So digital forensics is not simple. I did it because it sounded like a fun challenge, and it was definitely a challenge. It took me about a year between the about 8 weeks of courses, which once you graduate from college and you start in a company, 8 weeks in a year is a lot of training. Most employees average 1 to 2 weeks a year. So that was a lot, and it was very, very technical. That part was a challenge. And then when you look at that certification, it's not only a test, but it's a practical examination. The company that does the certification actually sends you a hard drive, and you have to analyze it and answer 13 questions. And it's got about a 40% pass rate, and it takes you about 80 hours to complete that part of the test. So it wasn't a small thing, but I would say it's one of the most valuable. It's definitely the most valuable certification I got. And in terms of giving me a huge basis of knowledge across all of IT, it was pretty phenomenal. So no regrets. I would do it over again. And at the end of the day, it was really fun. It opened up a lot of doors and on the law enforcement side too, to do a lot of fun stuff. So, well worth the one year huge challenge.
Aside of that certification, what other technical certs would you recommend for students?
What other technical certs?
Microsoft Certified Engineer, Linux, VMware.
So I'm not sure you can go wrong with the technical certs. And the reason that I say that is, again, it's about being well-rounded across different areas. So what I would say is, don't just focus on certs in the network area or in operating systems. Spread it out across the different areas of IT. Maybe get one network cert, maybe get one Linux or one Windows cert, and then get, you know, an application or two certification, like maybe look at SQL Server, you'll never get tired of SQL and InfoSec, because all of our logs are stored most of the logs are stored in databases. And your ability to write SQL queries to find stuff in your early years of InfoSec will save your life. So just take, you know, kind of a potpourri of different technical topics would be my best advice there.
Okay, thank you. Mindy, do you want to ask your question? Mindy?
Hi, that was actually kind of what I was going to ask. I'm a system admin. I have a master's in cyber and I have CISSP, but I do not work in cyber. And I don't really have any intention to, although I love it and I'm intrigued by it. So my curiosity was, what search should I be pursuing to just round out my career, I guess? So you kind of already hit it.
Yeah. I think if you love what you're doing on kind of the infrastructure, so this admin side, some of the best certs are like the CISSP, because it gives you that broad cyber background across a lot of different domains. And then like if you're a sysadmin on the network side, there's some SANS courses about, you know, network security that are kind of interesting, around the philosophies, like for example, of how to configure firewalls, from a security perspective, right? Because there's a sysadmin perspective and there's a security perspective, and they don't always get along. And so there's some interesting things there on how you can bridge kind of that divide.
I'm lucky to work in an environment where we have a lot of very security-minded sysadmins, both on the server side and on the network side. So we tend to take actions that cyber doesn't have to battle us. So it's a good work environment in that regard.
You are lucky then.
Yeah, we battle cyber all the time with their documentation and why we can't provide things that they think we ought to be able to provide. But the actual focus and intent of the 20 people I work with is very well-rounded. I appreciate where I'm at a lot.
That sounds awesome.
So Forrest, a very abrupt question, but how could my students pretty much apply for a job with you, pretty much? I mean, is there a best way where potentially they would be, you know, they would look interesting to you? What is their best way to appeal to your interest?
Yeah, there is. And I think it kind of aligns with the last question was, how do you get noticed? And so I would say definitely work on something that makes you unique compared to everyone else. That's one of the things that I look for, because I look for people to be passionate about something. I think most people, you can be most successful in your job if you become passionate about it. If you don't like going to work every day, you're probably not going to have a fantastic career. So you need to find something that you like and you can become passionate about. And that kind of, you know, we look for that in a resume. And so I say, and I'll say again, your resume needs to be a huge piece of marketing material. you need to think about the way that it looks. You need to think about the fact that an HR person is going to read it first. So you need to convince the HR people. And if you put something in there that makes them, that they see that's different than everybody else, I can guarantee you almost always, even if you don't meet the minimum qualifications, and I'm not supposed to say this, but I'll say it anyway, even if you don't meet the minimum qualifications, they'll sometimes put it in that manager review pile. And so, you know, like the example that I gave of the online personal training and nutrition site, where I had a guy making as much money as he was going to make at Ingram Micro with his side hustle. And that to me was kind of cool. He had thought through, you know, all the business elements, the financial elements, put together a good, you know, personal business, and showed entrepreneurial spirit all at the same time. And that to me gave me an indication he was going to be an awesome employee. So that's probably the best way, is finding out what your what unique thing you have and making sure to market that all over your resume. And then on the side, if you were to send me an email with your resume and say you were in this session, you'd probably also get my attention, and I'd send it off to the HR folks and ask them to to heavily consider it.
So are you in favor of one-page resume, multiple-page resumes?
It depends on your experience. So remember that there's time associated, money associated with time. So the person reading it wants to see valuable content. So if this is your first job out of college, unless you have work experience during college, significant work experience, you can probably limit it to one page. I can tell you my page after 20, or my resume after 20 years is 2 pages, no more. And that works. You just want to give people enough of an indication of what your top talents are, what your top accomplishments are. The rest of it, you're going to talk about in an interview anyway.
Okay. There was a question about LinkedIn from Dr. Burton. Do you think it's a good, valuable tool to get noticed?
LinkedIn?
Correct.
Absolutely. And your LinkedIn should be as polished as your resume, if not more so. I will tell you a lot of the jobs that we recruit for in the United States, we do what's called passive recruiting. So our recruiters will actually search LinkedIn for people and contact them proactively. And a lot of those jobs, we might not even post because we want to find very specific people, and we find them through LinkedIn. That is the only tool we use to find people. And I know that was the case at Nissan. It's the case at Ingram Micro. It is an extremely valuable tool. I would say we're security people. We don't like to put our pictures up. Put your picture up. Make it as personable as possible. You want to show the recruiter that you're a human being. And again, show them something unique about you that's not just job oriented. Be careful how you do that. There are certain things that are more appropriate than others. Remember, some companies are extremely conservative. So keep that in mind when you're posting stuff on LinkedIn. Also be very careful what you post on the social media side of LinkedIn, because companies are conservative by nature. So you cannot post on LinkedIn what you're going to post on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Make sure that it's business oriented, that it's not political, and that it's not, that it follows what would be considered the company's code of conduct. I know of several cybersecurity folks, I'll say mostly on the pen testing side, ethical hackers seem to have the hardest problem with this, that create a lot of problems for themselves by posting controversial content on social media. So if you're going to post controversial content, make sure that it's private and it can't be found by an HR investigator.
There's a question from... I guess Mr. Holmberg is military, and I guess he's making a career change. Would you have any reservation in hiring someone entry level that doesn't have technical background in the cybersecurity position?
Nope, no problems whatsoever. And we do a lot of that with law enforcement also. So between military and law enforcement, we absolutely do that. If you think about cyber forensics and law enforcement, they did the same thing I did, just without an IT background. They send them to exactly the same school. So these are guys that were patrolling streets, or federal agents looking at financial crimes. They literally go to Quantico for a couple months and they come out cyber forensic investigators, right? So I have no issue with that. I think the number one thing that folks not without a background in IT can do is make sure that you do a little bit of learning on the network side. Most of the investigators do what I'll call dead box forensics. They'll look at a single machine instead of the network element of cybersecurity. So that's definitely something that can help you out as you do some training preparing to transfer from military to civilian life. And then there's also programs that we participate in. So we actually do a veterans program here out of Orange County, where I take internships from the military that are preparing to transition out of the military. And we work with them on cybersecurity to see if that's something that they're interested in. So for whoever, I can't remember the name of the person that asked that question, but if you want to send me a separate email, I can link you up with some of those programs that we support and that other big companies support. that might help you navigate that.
Steven, I think you raised your hand. Would you like to ask a question, Steven? Okay, I guess he's gone. Okay, any other questions, anyone?
Really good information, really, really good. I think you've confirmed a lot of things that we were not sure about, but also provided some great new information. And I'm very glad to hear that LinkedIn is still the place to be, because that's what I've been telling everybody.
Yep.
Yeah, I tell my students that they need to prepare their resume 2 to 3 years before they start looking for a job, so that they start posting. I tell them to post maybe even papers. If it's a good paper, post it on LinkedIn. Could you confirm? I mean, would you see value in a student posting a term paper, for example, on LinkedIn to just show his interest on a topic of his own choice?
Yeah, absolutely. The only caveat I would put is make sure you got an A on it. So be careful about what you post. But if it's a good term paper, it again shows initiative, it shows your interest, your passion. Any of those things are going to be, be good things when an HR recruiter is looking, right? Again, you're trying to distinguish yourself from people who think that they can post 3 lines of "I went to college here" and expect a passive recruiter to find them and give them a job. So absolute, post as much as you can that's relevant, that distinguishes you from someone else.
That's great advice. I mean, just like a resume, your profile yep. needs to stand out, you know, from the pile. That's great. And yeah, there's a new field, or not new, but relatively new field in LinkedIn called projects and stuff. So there's actually mm-hmm. places where you can put those things. If you've done a webinar, if you've done a speech somewhere, you know, definitely add that up. So that's awesome.
One of the most interesting things you reminded me, one of the most interesting things I like to look at on LinkedIn is they used to have, and they may still do, an area where you can post your Slido presentations. And that's interesting to me because one of the biggest challenges in cybersecurity is getting people to write. Mm-hmm. And so business writing is a really key thing that I missed in the entire presentation. But your ability to demonstrate that through a term paper or a presentation is super helpful because that will distinguish you from your peers. Most technical people really struggle with business writing.
Yeah.
And in cybersecurity, that becomes more important because a lot of the products that we create go to the CEO and the board of directors. So they need to be well written. And so that will definitely distinguish you.
Good information. Yeah, and we just did one of our major competitions, and during the competition, they have to write nicely formatted memos to the CEO while they're trying to protect servers from being hacked. So they definitely demonstrate that in the competitions that we've done. And that's probably, like you said, it's one of the hardest tasks for them to sit down and write a well-drafted email to the CEO.
Right.
Ironically, you know, that's more difficult than cracking some of the intrusions they were getting. So this is great. I think very good information. Any other questions? Okay, just a reminder.
I was wondering about the stress level that you're under, and what kind of stress do you find that the people who are working for you are under generally?
Yeah, so I think one of the things, you after a while, you learn to condition and deal with that stress. I would say I didn't really understand how to control my stress level in information security until I became a cop. And then I really understood it because I was put in other situations where I had to use guns and other things. And I realized, wow, that's even more stressful. And so it's all perspective, I guess, maybe. We do encourage, we do a lot of LinkedIn learning around stress management, especially for the newer folks on our team, because it can become, and it's not just even stress, it's also work-life balance. When you get into an incident, it's hard for our guys to actually stop because they see the criticality of it, but you can't run yourself out by working 72 hours straight. Because at about hour 24, you start making bad decisions. And so part of that is conditioning kind of the stress and the work-life balance and putting it all together. And we do some programs and mentorship and coaching around that from some of our senior people. And we actually pay a lot of attention to it because it can become problematic.
Yep. I think we all struggle with work-life balance for sure.
Have you looked at a model to detect individuals that would potentially be in a situation of being in too much stress and risking an incident?
So we do look at, the managers are well trained, just generally speaking, but also in cyber, on looking for situations where people are too stressed, especially I would say the pandemic has not helped. And so we do have employee assistance programs that we regularly refer people to. And I would say probably in the last year, I've had maybe 4 or 5 conversations on this topic in a team of 150. So it's more common than you probably think. But the company does provide resources to help them with that, professional resources like therapists, psychotherapists, and whatnot, when we see people going down a path that maybe is unhealthy for them. And it is more common in cyber than other areas. I'll say that too. Definitely more common than IT.
I talk a lot in my classes about culture and the idea of developing a security culture within a business. And I was wondering, do you talk about that in your organization? Is that an important consideration, or am I barking up the wrong tree here?
No, I say the best countermeasure is our employees. And so that relies around a security culture. And when I joined Ingram Micro, I joined in October, which is supposed to be Cybersecurity Awareness Month. No one knew it was Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and people 2 cubicles in had no idea who I was. So yes, the cybersecurity culture was a challenge. We've since turned that around, and I actually have a team of 4 people whose entire job is creating a cybersecurity culture through training, awareness, activities, webinars, lunch and learns. And so I basically hired people that would normally be in a marketing department. And their job is to create a cybersecurity culture and awareness around the entire company of 35,000 employees. So absolutely agree that if you create the right cybersecurity culture, you create the right awareness, that is the best investment to reduce risk across the entire company, because 96% of risks come through employee or associate mistakes.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I've been talking about. I was wondering, from a C-suite leadership position, on the plus or minus, Hackful, do you find that to be in terms of your implementation and cybersecurity posture?
So I missed a very key part of your question because it cut out for me. Can you maybe restate it one more time?
Probably not exactly the same way that I did the first time, but I'll give it a try. From a leadership standpoint, from the C-suite, how impactful do you think that is, or do you see it is in your organization in terms of how it affects your ability to implement the way you want to and or adopt the cybersecurity posture that you want to within the organization? But from a cultural perspective, as well, just as a general leadership perspective.
Yeah, so people are much more inclined to support you if they have the background and the education around cybersecurity. So if they're unaware, they think things are not happening, then you're less likely to get support. I'm fortunate at Ingram Micro, because we're a technical company, to have pretty good support. But it was definitely a challenge at a car manufacturer to try to get support for cybersecurity. And in fact, we really didn't get it until we started pen testing our cars to get attention. And we found issues with our cars, and that within the company raised better awareness than any of the other cybersecurity things we were doing on the IT server side. And so it is about, again, that sales and marketing and getting out there. You absolutely need a culture around cybersecurity to get the full support. And in the C-suite, you have to find the right things that push their buttons. At a car company, it was, I found a problem with the car. At Ingram Micro, doesn't have to be so dramatic. They're naturally supportive. But it is a constant struggle. As I talk to my peers, you know, some companies hire a CISO to check a box, and others hire them because they really do want to reduce risk. And part of your job hunting process is figuring out the difference between the two, because you'll definitely be happier in one that wants to support you.
Great, thank you.
All right.
Well, I think it's almost time. Isaac, Forrest, thank you very much for accepting our invitation today. It was very informative to me, at least. So, Dr. Burton, would you like to conclude the meeting?
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Bacard, and thank you so much, Forrest, for joining us today. I appreciate all the information. I think it was a very informative talk. Just so you know, we have recorded it. This becomes a podcast. We put it on our website where everyone can review the website and see all the podcasts from previous webinars if you want to see that. And also just for those of you that are here, and if you accepted the invite, you have the recording on your invitation within a few hours or so. It'll post to there if you want to see that. But I think it was great. Thank you so much today for your time. I so appreciate it. I think you did an awesome job, and we're very well informed now. And now we know the source to come back and ask some more questions about the things we talked about tonight. Supply chain is still a big one for us. So I'm sure we'll speak again.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you guys so much. Have a great night.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good night. Appreciate it. Bye.
Thank you.